Welcome to Hub Headlines. Today's program features the best commentary and analysis published in the Hub for May 6th. Up first is Derek Hunter, writing on why we can't tax our way to prosperity.
The difference between practice and theory is that in theory there is no difference, but in practice there is. This line, attributed, possibly apocryphally, to Yogi Berra, seems to describe the Canadian taxation divide in the wake of the latest federal budget. Practitioners such as entrepreneurs, doctors, investors, small business owners, and others believe we should use the tax system to encourage risk-taking behavior because it results in a growing economic pie and a better average standard of living. Others, in particular academic economists, the Department of Finance, and left-wing journalists, disagree. Significantly, these naysayers do not actually invest capital for a living. In investment industry parlance, we would say that they have no skin in the game. Andrew Coyne on X even managed to characterize the capital gains exemption as a subsidy, which means, one supposes, that he considers my entire income to be the property of the state, which only deigns to let me retain a portion through its benevolence. Academic models dismiss the burdens of investing in illiquid investments, such as opportunity costs and risk of total loss. Indeed, the advocates of the dollar is a dollar theory, including Finance Minister Chrystia Freeland, argue that academic models suggest raising capital gains taxes will not threaten entrepreneurship or economic growth. They maintain that investors will continue to invest because it's in our nature, and we will simply select from the abundant assortment of attractive projects where the risks and time frames are well known, and the returns will be irresistible regardless of the tax rate. So, for the record, as a capital allocator who has been doing this for some time, I would like to put this theory to rest. Let me be as clear as I possibly can for those who believe such nonsense. Your models are wrong. Imagine that Canada was to eliminate the capital gains exemption and tax all returns at the same rate as income, because after all, a dollar is a dollar. Our company would immediately be much less likely to invest in any Canadian project where the expected return was in the form of a capital gain, in particular seed stage investments. Early stage companies, even the best ones, are inherently risky, and it would be very difficult to take that on knowing that half or more of the returns from the winners would be taxed away. I expect most of our peers would do the same based on recent commentary from groups including the Canadian Venture Capital Association and the Canadian Council of Innovators. Canadian investments would be largely limited to positions in bonds and dividend-paying oligopolistic stocks, of which Canada has quite a few, given the protected nature of many of our major industries. Technology and innovation would be devastated except to the extent it was supported by the Crown. With capital limited, entrepreneurs would leave in droves. This reaction, the opposite of what the models predict, should be obvious and expected by anybody engaged with reality. The fact that our finance minister and her advisors anticipate the opposite is a concern. Unfortunately, this is just the continuation of a trend starting with the tax on split income debacle of 2017 and followed by the Bear Trust fiasco of 2023, costing $1 billion in unnecessary compliance costs. Each of these cases should have provided a teachable moment. Practice is different than theory, but here we are. Immediately following her speech, Freeland posed the rhetorical question to a phalanx of journalists: what kind of Canada do you want to live in? If her just-delivered budget was anything to go by, Freeland dreams of a Canada in which unequal levels of wealth are resolved by aggressive acts of forced sharing. It is a Canada in which the shrinking remnants of a sclerotic economy are divvied up among select demographic groups, and the successful can always be asked to pay just a little more to inch ever closer but never quite reach their fair share. Apparently, her vision also never anticipates financial default, even when interest payments outgrow all the other spending priorities of the nation. It is a triumph of theory over practice, but ultimately, Freeland's vision is one of shared misery. My answer to Freeland's question is rather different. The kind of Canada I want to live in is one that applauds economic growth through the encouragement of entrepreneurship. It's one that is unhappy with the OECD prediction that we will have the worst economic growth of any OECD nation over the next 35 years and sees that as a challenge to be confronted and overcome. It's one that understands that shrinking per capita productivity means worsening living standards for everybody. It is also a Canada that recognizes that economic growth and financial stability are what underwrite the costs of the social supports that we expect in a modern developed economy. No country ever taxed its way to prosperity. That is a lesson firmly rooted in reality.
That was a commentary by Derek Hunter. He is the CEO of Blue Sky Equities Limited and is a trustee of the Hunter Foundation. You can find the full text of his article on our website, thehub.ca. Our second essay is by Caroline Elliott, writing on why public interest comes second with BC's HYDA agreement.
Recently, a public outcry forced BC's NDP government to pause amendments to the Land Act that would have allowed the province to give individual First Nations control over up to 95% of BC's public lands, despite the absence of a democratic relationship between those nations and more than 95% of the population. Now, they are headed down an equally troubling path as they advance legislation to implement an agreement recognizing HYDA title over the entirety of a group of islands known as HYDA Gwaii. Concerns have been raised about the agreement's potential impacts on private property and about the constraints it places on future governments' ability to act in the public interest. Despite HYDA Gwaii's remote location and relatively small population of about 5,000 people, this agreement has huge implications. The Premier himself has said he intends to use it as a template for other areas of BC. As law firm McMillan explains, Aboriginal title confers ownership rights similar to those associated with fee simple. These include the right to decide how the land will be used and who can occupy it, the right to possess the land, and the right to its economic benefits. While the agreement contains assurances that private property will be honored by the HYDA Nation, McMillan identifies numerous outstanding questions as to how such claims can be reconciled with the nation's right as title holders to choose how the land is used. Another law firm, Castles, echoes those concerns, writing that despite the government's assurances, private property interests and the implementation of Aboriginal title are ultimately at odds. The rights in land which flow from both a fee simple interest and Aboriginal title interest include exclusive rights to use, occupy and manage lands. The two interests are fundamentally irreconcilable over the same piece of land. Importantly, Aboriginal title is protected under the Constitution, while private property rights are not. When these irreconcilable interests are inevitably brought before the courts, it is easy to guess which will prevail. There is also the matter of other existing interests, defined as interests with respect to land, water, air, or subsurface resources. This includes permits and tenures, as well as those held by the province in relation to public infrastructure such as highways, hospitals, and schools. The agreement requires that decisions around such interests are to be made in accordance with Aboriginal title, something Castles explains will likely require the consent of the HYDA Nation. Critically, Castles notes the province appears in this agreement to have given up its ability to justify proceeding with a decision in the public interest in the absence of such consent. The Supreme Court of Canada has previously accepted such justification, something Castles calls a core governing tool used to balance Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal interests, in recognition of the fact that governments must legislate for societies as a whole. By giving up this tool, the province appears to have determined that, on HYDA Gwaii, an Aboriginal interest takes priority over any consideration of competing non-Aboriginal or broader societal interests. As I've written previously, policies like this raise important concerns from a democratic perspective. While consulting with Indigenous groups on land use is consistent with democratic principles and is already required by the courts, entering into agreements that effectively give Indigenous groups the power to govern over the broader public is not. This is because democracy demands that those affected by collective decisions have the right to participate in making those decisions, directly or through elected representatives. In this case, the HYDA Constitution, like most Indigenous constitutions, does not allow non-HYDA residents to vote in their elections. This is understandable when a nation's jurisdiction affects only its own citizens. However, when the province places its own broader decision-making powers into the hands of Indigenous governing bodies, there is a real problem because non-Indigenous British Columbians will be affected by, and even subject to, rules made by a government they have no role in electing. Indeed, the HYDA agreement itself was approved in a referendum held for HYDA Nation voters, but there was no such referendum for non-HYDA residents, who make up half the population of HYDA Gwaii. To be clear, indigenous groups themselves are not responsible for the issues identified here. Their task is to look out for the interests of their own communities, and they are doing just that. It is the provincial government that is responsible for representing the interests of British Columbians as a whole, and this agreement threatens its ability to do so. With the Premier's eagerness to replicate the agreement across BC, and with 95% of the province's land claimed as unceded territory by one or more of BC's 200-plus indigenous groups, the impacts are potentially massive for private property, the economy, democracy, and the public interest generally. And yet, the BC government is rushing the bill through the legislature in the last weeks of the sitting before an election. With such enormous stakes, they owe it to the public to hit the brakes on the legislation and give the people a say.
That was a commentary by Caroline Elliott. She is a PhD candidate at SFU, a commentator, and a candidate for BC. That's it for today's edition of Hub Headlines. We hope you enjoyed the program. To receive all our best commentary and analysis each morning by email, subscribe to The Hub for as little as 25 cents a day. You can do that right now at thehub.ca. Hub Headlines is produced by Alicia Rao. Thanks for listening.